Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session for the May City Council for Thursday, April 19th, 2012. I'd like to excuse Councilman Glover, who's out of town. And we're going to we'll proceed with item number one, which is to review the agenda for next Monday's council meeting. But we're going to do a little bit different because of some conflicting schedules that we have. And I'd like to apologize in advance. After we review the agenda, we're going to go into executive session and take care of a couple of items in that, and then we'll come back for the presentation. So there will be a little bit of a switch, if that's okay with everyone on the council. And then we'll come back and have all the presentations. Okay? So the first item on the agenda is to review next Monday's regular council meeting agenda. Page 2, items 3A through 3C, items 3D through 4B, (4C through 4G. I think the staff has requested that we pull item 4F from the agenda, so that will not be considered. Items 4H through 4L. (4M through 4O. (4P through 5E. Mr. Brady?
Yes. Do you want to go through the rest of the agenda, or you want to do this right now? We can do it now.
Let's do it right now.
Okay.
Is 5K connected to 5P?
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, we'll just have that entire project. Mayor and Council, this is a project at the intersection of Signal Butte and Elliott that we've been doing some work in. Some of it was some accelerated capital improvement work and utilities work that we were had accelerated to have in place in time for the opening of First Solar. As we've read in the news this past week, that project seems to be on hold, but we want to talk about this project and kind of where we stand and opportunities, the decision we made as far as whether to move forward with this project or not. So, Beth, you want to take the...
Good morning. Signal Butte and Elliott is important to us for a variety of reasons. It happens to be a major intersection in terms of our water system, believe it or not, because our water plant is there on the northeast corner. We have a number of major pipes that will come in and out of the water plant at that intersection. We also have the Fire Station 219 just to the north. We did an earlier project this past year to pave Signal Butte to the north and down through the intersection to serve the fire station, as well as to correct some stormwater ponding issues that were occurring out there. And so those projects went in and are completed now. This is one of the remaining corners of the intersection. It's the northwest corner and the southwest corner of the intersection. We'd be completing the roadway and the underground utilities along Signal Butte from the intersection south on the west side of the road, as well as on the south side of Elliott from the intersection west across the frontage of First Solar. In addition, we received Dan recently received a grant from Maricopa County DOT, Department of Transportation, to complete the north side of Elliott Road and along the same frontage. So we've received some county grant money to complete that. The other thing that's happening in this area is just to the south, DMB is in with their Eastmark subdivision, and they will be completing Signal Butte Road on the west side from Ray North in conjunction with that development and then part of Ray Road. So the road itself on the west side is beginning to develop out at Signal Butte. So there's a variety of things that are going on. We are committed in a development agreement with First Solar to complete this road, but there are also a variety of other things going on. One is the county grant that we recently received. The other is the development activity that we have starting to occur out in the area. We've recommended that we proceed with the project at this time. It's a good time to build. We're still getting really good prices on the building, and it'll really serve the entire area for development as things occur, particularly with things that are starting to happen in the Eastmark development.
Okay. Any questions?
Okay. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Once again, anything else? 4P through 5E? 5F through 5M? Six A through 8B. And 8C through 9A. Okay. All right, once again, I apologize for the change in the order. For all those of you who are here, we'll be as quick as we can, and we'll be back back in here for regular session. So I'll entertain a motion to enter new executive session. I have Councilmember Higgins, second from the Vice Mayor.
Yes. Mayor, if I just might, we want to, I believe there may be some desire to talk about one of the items on our study session agenda in executive session. So if that's correct,
yes.
We would need to
Mayor.
Add it to
Vice Mayor, let's do that. It's part of the. Go ahead.
Yeah, if it's okay with Councilwoman Higgins, who made the motion, I'd like to discuss item 2A, which is changing the signature requirements for the officers, Office of Mayor and City Council. As you know, we discussed this issue previously, and our concern was that the council, unless there was a change in state law, may have to have a higher level number of signatures to run for council office than the mayor would. The governor signed a bill not too long ago that would allow us to reduce the signature requirements to 250 for council, 1,000 for mayor. But there are some legal issues that and how we would put together an ordinance for that. So I'd like to discuss that in e-session.
Okay. Sounds good, guys. All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Moving into executive session. We'll now move on. We're gonna change a couple things around in the rest of the agenda. We will go through with 2A as the first item, and then we're going to jump to item 2F, since there's a lot of people here on the parks. We'll go to the Parks Capital Improvement Program as the second item. Or the first item.
Well, go ahead. I don't want to. Just go to your first item.
I will do. No,
we'll sit there and observe.
Just no, we'll.
You want to do?
We'll do 2F first, then we'll come back. It doesn't really matter. Let's just do 2F since you're already sitting there. So we'll do 2F, and then we'll go back to 2A from there. Okay. I think it was. Mr. Hirschberg.
Good morning, yours.
Council. As promised during our budget presentation, we are back to present the capital improvement program, proposed working capital improvement program. I think what we've put together here is a good mix of projects and concepts based on the feedback that we've gathered from not only the creation of our own 15-year strategic plan within the department, also from citizen surveys, working with our Parks and Recreation Advisory Board and the IMESA Steering Committee. And representing both of those groups with me is Kathleen Rand from the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board and Mark Schofield with the IMESA Steering Committee. And I'll run through this presentation, then I know they have a couple words. I also provided you copies, wasn't sure if it would pull up electronically for you, so I put copies in front of you also. We've kind of divided these into a number of different categories, looking at first of all, a general map of the city and where these programs are, trying to touch as many different places of the city as we can and spread those out. First project is Riverview that we want to talk about and kind of what it would take to make that truly a regional showcase park. And this is a new rendering of what you've seen in the past. What we're working on now is putting everything, all those amenities that are there now, back into the park as we go through that renovation project on that site for the spring training project. We're looking at doing is, again, as I mentioned, is really taking that to the next level, updating that play space, which is in that top quadrant there, and really this area here, and really trying to make that one-of-a-kind, unique showcase area, trying to add some new elements as you look at the 101 and the 202 as the main entryway into the city for those coming in from Sky Harbor, coming back from work, whatever the case is. Really, how do we make that an iconic piece?
Hey, Mark, real quickly, surface area of the lake in relation to the current one, how does that compare? Mayor,
currently, the lake kind of sits right here in this area, as you can, and it sits below the street grade. What we're talking about doing is bringing it back up to street grade and expanding that, obviously.
By how much?
Surface area is about the same. We're just trying to change the shape and configuration to make that a showcase piece. One of the things, as we all know, is the importance of the lake to the community from an urban fishing standpoint. So we've created these little nodes here of both natural landscape and hardscape along there, so both pedestrians can use it, and then the fishermen have places to do that as well.
They can cast without catching
people.
That depth of the lake is deeper, about the same, I think.
We're actually working with the state fish and game
and
on
fish,
helping us design the lake and give us those depths and everything. So.
But I mean, the thing is that the lake's not getting any smaller. It looks like it's got more amenities. It looks like it's almost more usable because of the way the design it is, and it's. You hope that it'll maintain what you have, but then also enhance the overall use of the lake. Is that
correct? And like today, it's limited as far as the hard surface where families with strollers and whatever can make it around the lake. Today, this would allow for more of that, certainly.
Right.
The other thing is that the two, I don't know what you want to call them, the two green areas on the west end, north and south, they're shown as green areas here. In the future, they could potentially also be commercial pad sites.
Gotcha.
So we've kind of designed it with that thought.
So if you wanted to, you could put a little restaurant out there with lakeside dining and things
that's
like that.
Direction, that's
what
direction.
Okay.
What is that? How does that affect the total acreage of the park if you're to do that? What is it now? What is it under this configuration? And then
I think the park actually grew with this configuration because we went so much further. Think about it, the parking lot. You don't see the parking lot that's between the softball fields.
We've
moved everything into that parking lot, so we've actually gained acreage. And I would have to figure out what the net would be with the pad size, but I think it's still we balanced out pretty close. And then remember, what we've done is taken that soccer field that's to the east of Riverview Drive, and now you've picked up, I don't know what this acreage is over here on the west of that with all those soccer fields, so really the netting up number is huge.
So we've turned existing parking lot, which isn't really usable space, and a soccer field,
and
now it's all usable park.
Right, and then Councilman, what you don't see, again, I'm sorry, to the far west, we pick up those four
baseball
fields that will be available outside after the
spring training,
but they're community use for. So this is a netting up of a huge amount of acreage for public use park.
Great, and thanks.
You also don't see that existing softball quad.
Yeah, to
that's
the
there too. That'll remain as long as until future development occurs.
Okay.
The next four projects are what we're calling exchange properties that. Right now, that back to Riverview, if you can imagine the park now, this portion that I'm kind of going over with the mouse currently has a federal encumbrance on there as it was built with Land and Water Conservation Fund dollars. In order for that development to potentially occur on that site in the future, we need to free up that property, remove those federal encumbrances so the city can do what we'd like to do as we envision in the future with that. So working with the federal government, we've identified four different projects and properties where we're replacing that existing parkland at Riverview with surplus parkland and adding new amenities. First one is an area you talked about earlier this morning, Signal Butte and Elliott. You can see the water treatment facility there. There's a great wash through here now. We'd like to add an interpretive trail around the water treatment facility, connecting the wash and telling the story of water and possibly getting SRP involved as their station is up here, and how does the story of power and water and how that works together. Yes, Mayor?
I'm just amused. Soaking in the story of water. It's just
it's going to tie. Remember, we pull water from the canal to the east of here, pull it, this is the treatment plant that will be coming. And since we already own all of this property, the thought is let's turn it into an asset as opposed to just putting up a gate around the treatment plant and just having non-usable public area. So we've got a lot. We have very few park space in this part of Mesa, Far East Mesa. So this gives us an opportunity to use land that we already currently own. We could actually go out there and start doing some of this work now. We get the benefit of the exchange with the federal government, and we really like the idea because it complements, kind of as a buffer, if you would, to this fairly large, what will somewhat look like an industrial plant, and you create it as a buffer for the neighbors in that area. And take advantage of this natural wash, which is a fantastic natural asset out there.
Yeah. Any way to get water in that wash? No. Part of the design?
We could
percolate water through there, recharge?
We could look at it. We'll take a look. It's pretty dry right now, but maybe.
Right. I mean, if you're going to talk about it as a natural amenity, is there a way? We're right next to a water treatment plant.
Yeah.
Is there any way to?
Not waste
water. Well,
no, I know, but pre-treat. Even if,
we'll take a look at it. We'll take a look at it. We'll take a look at it.
Vice Mayor.
You hear that now. And Chris, is a security concern looking at it, it's going to be, it's tucked back in between SRP and the water treatment plant itself. So there's going to be some limited visibility. So we'll have to have PD look at this and create some kind of a...
Yeah, our parks rangers will look at it. I mean, we have the fire station here.
Yeah, I saw that.
And frankly, that's kind of buried back there. But you're right. It's something we'll have to continue to look at. It's just, for us, this was an easy way to take city property, already been purchased, and then what we'll do with the feds is we'll actually agree to designate this as park area. Okay. And so we're proposing to do some of that. This is a fully built out plan. This is multiple years, but at least this gives you a concept of what we're trying to do.
Okay, excellent. Let's move along.
And to Mr. Brady's point, a lot of these plans show build out. Again, these are all conceptual, just so we could kind of see as staff what fit on there, what would work, what the future would bring. Another exchange property at Medina and Haas. City owns this property because of the pump stations on each corner. We would look at adding some natural paths in here, some turf area, eventually upgrading the landscaping around there, bringing the desert back in with some open lawn area there to play, and eventually a playground, restroom, parking lot. Next property is at McKellops and Ellsworth, next to Zaharis Elementary School. Again, taking advantage of a wash that's there and creating a riparian trail through there that the school can also utilize as an interpretive path and an outdoor classroom, eventually adding some, with that great desert that's out there, bringing in some turf for open play, and eventually looking at ball fields if that's the community's desire. Next property is at McDowell and Wrecker. And this is an existing water tank site, a hill there. And one of the things that we saw through IMESA was a request for bike trails. And what we would essentially create here is an urban bike park. Kind of a neat concept where you look at different skill levels of trails from single track for mountain bikes to a kids' BMX zone. And a lot of these properties that we're talking about, we're creating, just formalizing the social paths that are already out there now.
You're formulating the sociopaths that are
no.
over there?
Social.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear that correct. I was thinking of his security concerns. And at least we don't have sociopaths out of Signal Butte and Elliott.
Sociopaths?
The next three sites focus on potential joint school projects and looking at how do we work with the schools and expanding some of those facilities for more public use. First one was that also showed up in IMESA a lot was expanding on the regional pool concept. The idea here is to put a 10-lane, 25-yard pool at Mesa High with a beach entry, a slide, and some splash play area. Potentially looking at a couple of locations. The first one it could be at Southern and Harris. If we were able to work with the schools on that location, they've requested us to also look at additional parking in the back of the school, so that's what the cutout is there. Another potential location for the pool is back there where that gray spot is on that cutout also.
Yeah, Alex.
Very quickly, I know there's ongoing discussions and looking at details, and we have a great long-term partnership with the Mesa Public Schools, and I've always appreciated that. I feel like it saves taxpayers money. I would hope that we look for every opportunity to utilize the Skyline model that we used on the last regional pool. I think that's important in participation, and my pushback would be that however that those negotiations go, that somehow we get as close as we can to the Skyline model. So, and I haven't had a chance to pass that on to the folks at Mesa Public Schools, and but it's definitely a big concern for me. So,
and Councilor, I appreciate that comment. And one of the things we're looking at is how each entity uses those pools, the frequency, and looking at it, getting to a split, which gets us a little bit close to that Skyline. But it, you know, but the idea is how often are you going to use it should be part of the consideration too. So,
well, and as we, I don't know, do schools have a preference on that Mesa High pool location? My guess is that they would,
yes,
like the back side better than the front side.
Yes, we're working with both of them. And they're, Dr. Hogan, my counterpart at the schools that I work with, he has, if we can work with the schools to get the pool at Southern and Harris, he has an idea for additional amenities in the back half that he's trying to work through his process as well. But yes, the initial comments would be to on the back part of the where the driving range is now.
But as I'm understanding, what they would request is that if it did go up front, which there's I think there's a lot of good arguments for putting it right up there on Southern Avenue,
right,
that those 327 parking spaces would be part of the
total project.
The total project. Okay.
Mesa Junior High, there's been a lot of talk about this site and where it's going, and one of the ideas that's out there is converting it from school to park. The school district has expressed a desire to keep both the auditorium and library building, which is there on Broadway, as well as the gym and the classroom annex that's next to it. We would look at expanding the parking there, and then possibly looking at expanding the playground at Lowell. Right now, Fraser Drive currently goes through the middle of that property. We rework that roadway for the buses to be able to access and may easily make turns for drop-off and loading. And then adding eventually three lighted soccer fields, two lighted softball fields, and two Little League fields.
Councilman Higgins.
Thanks, Mayor. There's a school no longer there, or is it coming down? This is currently, I mean, this picture... Sir, there's buildings there, right? I'm kind of getting
Mayor,
confused.
Councilwoman, yes. There's currently buildings there. This is one of the sites that the school has identified as a site that's too costly to put any more improvements into. And possibly looking at demoing those buildings that are no longer sustainable.
But, yeah, no, Mesa Junior High stays, but the smaller stuff.
No, I'm sorry. That's what I'm trying to answer. This is the final year, I believe, for Mesa Junior High.
Oh, okay.
So they will no longer have at least a presence for the junior
high. So what they would look at doing is you can sort of see those on the printed thing. You can see the outline of the existing academic buildings. The academic buildings and cafeteria and admin buildings would all be demoed and reduced to dirt. And the auditorium, the gym, and the PE classrooms, I guess is the best way to describe that, next to the gym would stay because those we could reuse as community assets.
Next.
Once again, with the schools, you're discussing demo plans, all that kind of stuff, and that's all going to factor into our cost sharing that Councilman Fenner brought up. These things would all have to factor into the overall cost of doing this.
Correct. We want to share this with council, kind of show the ultimate plan. Obviously, some of these are multiple phases. We need to go back to the school district, see what their participation level is or interest is, how they would program or want to program some of this use. And then we just need to kind of make a decision for ourselves, you know, this, how that plays out for the city, and whether there's an opportunity to do joint projects, or what the limitations of those might be.
Next project is kind of a two sides of the street project, if you will, looking at a West Mesa sports complex utilizing both PAL, or the Mesa Education Center, as they're calling it now, and Kleinman Park, so at Extension and 8th there. At the Powell site, first of all, we would look at rearranging the existing baseball field that is closer to the home plate's closer to Redbird Elementary School towards extension. We would rearrange that and bring it closer to the parking lot, add some additional parking in there. Looking at we would work with the Little Leagues to propose doing skinned infields here and portable mounds and 300 feet with portable fencing in there to get multiple uses in there for both coach pitch, Little League, and then also adult softball at this site as well, along with two lighted Little League fields, creating a stronger pedestrian crossing at 8th with Kleinman, which I'll go to next.
Okay, Mark. Councilmember Kavanaugh has a question.
And again, just a question. Your recommendation for doing the skinned infields really is to provide a great deal more flexibility for a whole variety of programs there. Is that correct? So that actually strengthens the potential use of the site, would you say?
Mayor, council member, absolutely. The more uses we can get on that site and the more flexibility we have, we'll help all the different age groups and programming from kids to adults.
Thank you.
Baseball is played on grass infields.
Going across 8th to Kleinman Park, again, there's currently two softball fields there now. Those fences are a little bit shorter, so we'd look at rearranging, realigning, and extending those fields to the full 300 feet so we can let adults actually hit home runs there if they can. Right now, they fly over the fence a lot, so we have to implement different rules at that site. There's also some tennis courts and a wheel park there that are no longer used at very hardly at all, if at all, at this location as the demographics in the city have shifted. So we'd look at putting three soccer fields where those are. Basketball courts stay and existing playground stays, as well as the restroom and concession building there.
Yeah, Councilor Finn.
Could you just tell us, I know this year I think there's going to be an expansion of the youth softball program. I think that it's coming down in a quick nutshell. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, Mayor, council member, one of the things that our athletics team has worked on is reaching out and providing more of a recreational softball program for those between the ages of 13 and 18 that don't necessarily go on to competitive play, both male, female, and co-ed leagues we're offering now.
And I think that's wonderful. That's getting back to the good old days, the way I see it. And I know our good mayor and others have had a lot of hand in working with staff to get that. So I think that's a great thing that should be noted. So.
Thank you, council member. This is an overall concept. If both of those sites were put together and you looked at this as the total West Mesa sports complex, you could see how that would interact there. One of the next projects we're looking at is Monterey Park. This is the existing park. We would work it on some land swaps, land acquisition to make this site eventually work in phases. But there really is a need for more playing fields on this side of the city. We also have a number of complaints from the neighborhood about parking on Monterey Avenue. So really what that does is pull all that parking into that site and put a little bit of a buffer with a playground, expanded open play area between the neighborhood and those ball fields there.
Vice Mayor?
I know this is just conceptual, but what I might suggest is that if we do move forward with this project, we might want to look at some of the configuration and not just design for the particular piece we're looking to acquire. In past conversations, I know how important it is for you to have the four ball fields in a clover configuration. Looking at this schematic, I think you have the opportunity to do that and then move the soccer fields around and utilize some of the existing park space and repurpose some of that. So I would consider that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't expand out to the existing Monterey. If you put fields in the middle there, do you really think that people are going to park up here, or do you think they're still going to try and park along Monterey because it's a shorter walk? Consider that.
Yeah, we have time for that.
Yeah, just consider that kind of stuff.
Good point.
Just because you put parking up there.
No, we need to put parking closer over to the other part of Monterey probably too.
Yeah, I would say, you know, where that kids thing is, you know, that would be a good place for parking mid type, and then do, integrate maybe some rehab or some reuse of the existing park. Is that also, it's been a while since I've been out there, is that also a retention basin, the Monterey, or is that just a straight park?
The park is, yes.
The park is, so that's... Yes.
That's why it's set.
That's recessed.
It sets down and okay. Then it flows to the south there.
All righty. Okay.
Into the drainage canal.
Okay.
Next project that's proposed out there is Pioneer Park. Again, this is a completely conceptual plan, just trying to show the different amenities that could fit in there. Lots of discussion about botanic gardens and how do you integrate some of that into this location. One of the... as well as remembering our past through the pioneers of the city. And along with that, one of the things I'd like to propose out there for something to consider is the addition of a veterans memorial, something that Mesa doesn't have. I think this would be a good location for that. What we're kind of proposing, though, on this location is looking at some more passive recreation, some of the more plantings, formal gardens, closer to Maine, and then pushing the active play and active recreation with interactive water play, et cetera, towards the back half of the park there. So just, again, very conceptual, expanded play area for the community to enjoy, adding a grove of trees and picnic gardens, and really embracing the natural plantings and formalizing those gardens.
Councilman Kavanaugh?
And just to comment, I think what you're talking about here is a very good complement to where the light rail station will be, or the beginning of the line of the station for at least a period of time. And I like what you're proposing in terms of Main Street. I think it creates a very nice signature look to be adjacent to that light rail station and park and ride. Thanks.
Aviary.
Alex, you didn't mention that. You have to mention the aviary, too.
And exploring the options of an aviary.
Oh, sorry, just sort of blurted out. It's my Tourette's kicking in. Aviary.
The number one project that came through on iMesa was the Buckhorn Bass location. What we would look at through this is just land acquisition at first and then working with the community to identify what options are available there. I know that on iMesa there was a suggestion of ball fields, but maybe this may not be the best location for ball fields, but maybe it becomes a historical park, some sort of interpretive park, living history park, all sorts of different options there, but working with the community to explore those options. Downtown Urban Plaza was another item that showed up in iMesa. We've just kind of put a downtown city block on there, kind of the area we're sitting in now, to explore that idea further.
Yeah, Councilmember.
Yeah, I mean, have we looked at, once light rail comes down, where our activity center will be? And is that where you were thinking with something, or was the iMace idea, Urban Plaza, to, you know, focus where our parties are going, because we can't have fireworks in downtown Main Street, or if we have light rail coming down the street, right? We can't have the chairs in the middle of Main Street, is what I'm saying. So, you know, have you, is that kind of, maybe you can expand it here. Well, I see Mark Schofield shaking his head, so.
Let the other Mark maybe can weigh in on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Councilman Higgins and Mayor.
That's okay.
Did I say Councilman?
You did call me a man.
I apologize.
My husband gets really mad when people call me a man. Yeah.
I will say it's because I'm battling, I'm on antibiotics and no telling what it's doing to my brain. So, the idea behind the Urban Plaza really is to have a central gathering area, much like you see in other cities that have been successful at doing this, where they can have these types of activities. When we had the Republican National debate here, we had to close off Maine. And it was we were the only location for these debates that actually did something like this, which I thought was an incredible idea for the city to have moved forward with, and had a big screen out there. It was a party atmosphere, but it was a very mild party atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But it was really exciting. The people that attended enjoyed it, and I just went there to really observe and see how it went. if we had an urban plaza really in the location that we would like to see, which is just east, the parking lot east of the city building right now, the high-rise there on Main Street, along with the parking lot to the north, and making that whole area, and I'm not sure if I can, I'm not as good with this mouse as here, but from this area right here all the way through, this entire section here turned into an urban plaza, you now have a gathering area, you know, Central Park in New York City, Times Square, et cetera, type of thing, where you can have activities all the time there. Because in the evenings and on the weekends, you're not going to have problems with a lot of residences around and concern there with that. And again, it becomes a gathering place. It's right there by light rail. It's right there with the Mac. So it makes it really an all-encompassing vision that we as the committee at IMESA committee, we received feedback from the community on this. This was something that they mentioned. You know, we really don't have an identifying area for the city, and this would be kind of that signature piece. And this really is, this piece of property is the crown jewel for downtown redevelopment. And if it were to be used for other purposes, once it's gone and not able to be used in this manner, and we're going to be hamstrung with the type of development that a lot of people have envisioned for downtown. These other buildings, and I'll just say this very quickly, these other buildings that are along here, whether the city keeps them or not, or decides that maybe these locations would be better for residential, where they're kind of butting up against the plaza, may be a consideration. But yes, we would like to see this reserved for the urban plaza so that there is that gathering area.
Thanks. That's a good description. Appreciate it.
Councilman Fenter?
So what would you do with the parking lot just east of the main building, Mark?
Pardon?
The parking lot just east of the main building. What are your thoughts on that?
I would like to see that as part of the urban plaza.
Yeah.
I think using that for residential or commercial, it ends up blocking the open space area that other cities have found that in a downtown area that you have this urban plaza would be, it would disjoint if we were to lose that piece, which again is the crown jewel piece. Because it is right there on Main. If that were to go away, then you now have an you don't have the consistency for a plaza, even though you were to build a plaza here, because we would want that to tie in with the art center.
Yeah, I heard those comments last night, too, so thank you.
One of the things we hear a lot on our feedback is the existing park system. We've showed you a lot of new ideas and different concepts to add new amenities to our system, but we'd also like to see some reinvestment into the existing amenities. The average age of our playgrounds is over 13 years old. We have 24 playgrounds in our system still that are more than 15 years old, with the oldest being 27 years old. So you can see there's some room in there for improvement of those existing amenities. We'd like to explore those, whether it's lighting upgrades, playground replacements, irrigation upgrades and replacements to make sure we're getting even watering and some of those methods have changed as well.
And I'm assuming with a lot of those upgrades, like you said, the watering, our water systems aren't I would assume, are not as efficient as new technology, modern technology, would allow us to be. So a lot of these is just not changing one monkey bar to another monkey bar, but it's actually upgrading to the new technology that hopefully would create savings in both water and costs and things like that. Right. Is that part of the design?
Mayor, correct. Absolutely.
Is that a setup question or what?
We have a number of parks that still water on a 24-hour basis because they were designed as a single-zone system, so they're still watering on a 24-hour cycle, which means we're dropping water during the summer wet the hottest time of the day, so we have more evaporation occurring most likely than hitting the ground. at those rates. And the maintenance on playgrounds these days, have, as well as the irrigation systems and lighting systems, has changed. Lighting technology changes on a regular basis. The newer playgrounds that we've installed, there's less maintenance on those, and the inspections that we do keep them up to that par, so we're spending less money on replacements there as well.
Thank you.
Alex? With regard to lighting upgrades, one of the things I think, it's been so long since there's been a parks bond that's gone through the city. From day one, almost 4 years ago, what I was hearing from folks is we have these retention basins. There's no lighting at them. You know, everybody is struggling to find a space to do their soccer program or their little baseball league programs. And I think the smartest money spent is taking already existing assets and upscaling them. So retention basins that aren't parks could easily become a functional park with lighting and really take some of the space concerns. And when you do that across the city, then I think you find that you have a lot more support from folks when they feel like they're going. So I think the lighting upgrades and retention upscaling is really important as you kind of roll out programs. So just a personal opinion.
That's good.
Thank you. One of the things that Mr. Clevenger will introduce during his presentation is also there was some pedestrian bike trail projects identified in I-Mesa, and Dan will highlight those during his budget presentation. But I think one of the next steps, that we've gathered a lot of feedback from you guys, from council today. If there's more discussion, we'd be happy to entertain that. But then working with both the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board, the Transportation Advisory Board, Mark and the I-Mesa Steering Committee, to host a series of community meetings over the next 6 weeks or so, gather some feedback and input from them, see where those areas of additional playing fields are, park improvements, and just the general feel and how people react to these ideas and concepts that are out there. Come back and present those to you at the end of May and see if you have any interest in continuing to move forward.
And Mayor and Council, what we would do also at that time is bring back to you a proposed scope as far as the dollar amounts and more details of the actual dollar cost for these projects. We kind of get that feedback from the community with the idea that if you're interested at that point, based on the input from the community and where we sit as far as the actual cost of the entire bond, then they would give us time to make a decision in June to whether or not the decision whether or not to call the election.
And I want to just expand on what you said, and I thank you for the process, and thanks so very much for being here. The input from the community, it's not an accurate decision, because a lot of these things are bottom-up. These are not council or staff recommendations, which I think is wonderful. The purpose is to create community-based ideas that rise up rather than having us come up with some grandiose scheme and say, okay, now what do you think about it? I know there's some mix in here. It's things that we've developed because of the exchange on Riverview, things like that. So there's some things that are staff generated. But a lot of these ideas came from both the Parks Board and from I-Mesa, which means they're citizen generated. And I really appreciate that, because that sort of, I hope, gives us an idea of what the community wants. And then it's up to us to react and respond and figure out whether we're going to go back to the community to ask if now that they have these great ideas, do they want to invest in them? So I appreciate that process and look forward to seeing as it evolves a little bit more, we get more input back from the schools and see what role they are willing and able to play on those joint use projects, and then get feedback both from the I-MESA and the Parks Advisory Board as to how strongly the citizens feel on some of these things, like Buckhorn. You know, I've seen some preliminary ideas that came out of some ideas, and I love the fact that it's there, because that is purely a citizen-driven initiative that Vic and Ron Peters, Vic Lindhoff in the audience, really have driven that. Thank you so very much. And now I'd love to see some of your alternative thoughts on that, as opposed to maybe a youth sports thing, because I think they have a lot of merit to at least look at. So thank you.
And Mayor and Council Members, I'm Kathleen Ron, a member of the Parks and Rec Board, and just wanted to take a minute to kind of explain the process, how we got to this. It was indeed the staff presented some ideas that were developed from IMESA. Most of us on the Parks Board participated in that process. Also, from surveys, we feel very positive about all these ideas because it's utilizing our already existing parks but upgrading them and improving the quality of life for our citizens. We also believe it's a real partnership because it covers the entire city of Mesa. No matter where you live in Mesa, within your neighborhood, there's going to be something that's going to be upgraded that your family can use. So we think that that was a very important part of that. And the IMESA steering committee met with us and went over their ideas. The staff did a great job of presenting us with plans and ideas of what things look like now and how they can improve. So I just wanted to assure you that it was a real collaborative effort, and the Parks and Rec Board is really happy to be part of this process.
Thank you, which is how it should be. Appreciate that. Okay. Any other questions?
What's our schedule for? We're going to do a bond package this year. We're going to have to talk about that very soon.
Right, and that's why what we thought we'd do is, I think what the proposal is that we've received a tremendous amount of input that's gotten us to where we are today from the various boards and the citizens. But now that we've kind of drawn up some of these plans, we thought it'd be nice to take these back out to the community, get some further input, validation, and then in about a month, 4 weeks or so, come back to the council. We're thinking maybe doing 3 or 4 community meetings across the city, come back to the council with that input. I think what we're trying to do is take all of these projects. Obviously, we can't do all of this and all phases of these. But the idea is to kind of come back with a scale to the council and say, here's what we heard from the community of most interest, and whether they may have different ideas or pretty much the same. And also bring to you, the council, is here's how much the dollar amount we propose to go forward and what that would mean to the community. And then the council would then have the opportunity to make a decision in June whether or not to move this forward to a November election.
Okay.
Is that?
That's tight.
And, if there's other things we can do, let us know. But that's
well, and we don't have to all chew, bite these off all in one.
Right. No, that's the point, is we're trying to.
Yeah, I think, once again, to refine, this is not the normal way we've done things where the council comes up with some ideas. This is driven from the bottom up, which means that there's this package. And now we need to decide how much we can do now, how much we want to do later. These are several phases in these projects, and that's, right. I guess, our
right.
Task.
We'll bring that to the council, work with
this
you.
This isn't an all-or-nothing kind of a deal. We can figure out whether we want to do it now, next year, never, 10 years from now. I don't know how that would play out. Yeah, Mark.
Mayor, if I may, Mayor, City Council, just take 1 minute. First of all, we've enjoyed working with Mark and the city staff on the Parks and Rec area, as well as the Parks and Recreation Board. But I really wanted to take a moment and thank the City Council and the Mayor for the work they've done in putting the city in a position to consider these types of projects after having to go through and work diligently and finding over $80 million worth of savings for the taxpayers of the city. I think it's something that the taxpayers and the citizens often don't realize the work that you do. And in saving over $80 million from the city budget is quite an undertaking. In addition to that, recently, with the bonds and the refinancing that took place on some municipal bonds and being able to keep costs low for the citizens and keeping utility costs down, this is important for the members of the community to recognize the work that has been done by the City Council and Mayor and city staff in putting the city in a position that we can move forward on these ideas that have come from the citizens that will make Mesa a better place to live. And I appreciate you giving me some time to make that comment.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Okay, well, I'll move on to item 2A, discuss and provide direction on changing signature requirements for the Office of Mayor and City Council. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I asked this to be placed on the agenda. We had discussed this issue previously, but there were some confounding factors. Essentially, what it is, it's becoming, because of the increase in size of the population, it's becoming rather onerous in signature collections for folks to be able to run for mayor. We had a very robust discussion at the council several months ago about this and felt that it should be easier to run for office, not harder. One issue with the population shift had potentially placed my successor and Councilwoman Higgins in a position to have to collect well over 1,000 signatures just to run for city council. The mayor currently is 2,700, and that can climb. Fortunately, with some new state laws, we are able to adopt an ordinance that would allow signatures to be reduced to 1,000 for mayor and 250 for city council. And I think that given that, in fact, we should have more people run, encourage people to run for office, it would be worth pursuing that. We have an opportunity here in a very short time frame to draft and adopt an ordinance that would be effective immediately for mayor. Council, unfortunately, because the law doesn't that was just passed by the governor doesn't come into effect until August, will take a little bit longer. Fortunately, the three council districts that are running don't have to collect too much more than 250 signatures anyway at this point. So I would like to consider drafting an ordinance and passing it, or perhaps drafting two ordinances, one for the mayor to become effective with this election, one for the council that would become effective in 2 years. And I guess what I would like to do is turn it over to the city attorney for a brief discussion on what the possibilities are.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor and council, we have a number of options for the council's consideration. If you want an ordinance changing the number of signatures required for the office of mayor, if you want it to impact this election, we will have to adopt it with an emergency clause. We can do that on Monday, if that's the council's direction. As the vice mayor said, with regard to the other council districts, it cannot be effective for this election because the state law has not yet gone into effect. So we can pass one ordinance with both mayor and council included on there, with the expressly stating that it will not apply to the district council members until the new state law is in effect. We can pass two ordinances, one just addressing the office of the mayor with an emergency clause, and a second addressing the council districts without the emergency clause and stating that it will become effective upon adoption or effectiveness of the state law. Or you can go forward just with the mayor's position, mayor's ordinance now, and we can come back in the fall and address the council districts. So whatever the council prefers, we can accomplish.
Councilman Richens.
Let's do the mayor now and do the council in the fall, because there's no reason to rush on the council side of it, because it doesn't change anything. But the mayor is existing law in the state, and to me, let's take advantage of it.
The reason that I think Alex shared in some of my concerns, the council as a whole, and the reason we didn't move forward with this several months ago was because we had the there was a possibility that if the mayor's changed to 1,000 and council's never was changed, that particularly on the east side, you would have council members having to collect more signatures than what the mayor is. What I might suggest is that we, now that we have the opportunity to move forward, that we move forward with the mayor's immediately with emergency clause. We move forward at the same time with the council's, and since it's not going to change anything in the next 90 days, we could simply draft the ordinance, pass it through its normal process, and have it implemented as soon as the legislature is out plus 90 days. And that way everything, administratively, everything is done at the same time.
Mayor?
Yeah,
from a timing standpoint, when the state legislation takes effect and our legislation would take effect, can you walk me through the timing of that again?
Yes, what we would try and do is in our ordinance, we would say, we're talking just the council district positions, that this ordinance would take effect upon, you know, the state law as amended taking effect. So because we don't have a specific date of when that state law is going to take effect, it'll be 90 days after signee dies. So,
oh, okay.
So we don't have a specific date. That would be the easiest. Or we can say it's going to be effective October 1st or September 1st, because presumably it will be then, but
so
again,
you
we don't
said
know
we can write it so it our law triggers when the state law goes into effect.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds fine.
Two ordinances.
Yeah, two different ordinances, though.
I'm
sorry. Let's confirming the number of signatures required for the mayor under this proposal is 1,000 or 1,200?
1,000 or 5%. Well, actually, you can set it. It says in the state statute, it says you can adopt it by ordinance, setting a minimum of 1,000 signatures or 5%, whichever is less.
Yeah. And then the council signature requirement was what?
250
and
or
that's,
5%.
Well, that's a number that came out of, I believe, Councilmember Glover's. I wasn't at the meeting, but those of you who were, Alex, was that? I understand that's a
I
number
thought it
that
was
came
200. But maybe I.
The statute says 250.
Yeah, but we can set our whatever we want. Right?
Not below 250.
Not below 250.
So 250 is what
we. Scott, Mr. Butler, I think has some clarification.
Yeah, Mayor and Council, after the discussion that happened here previously on this issue, we went to the legislature and found a piece of legislation that was moving through with the town of Gilbert dealing with this very same issue, clarifying the Scottsdale changes in 2009 that impacted at large. Council at large elections, which in Mesa only affects the office of mayor. What we did at that point was try to get some input from the legislature about a threshold they felt would be acceptable to them. I believe the city of Phoenix is around 250 signatures, and that's the number that didn't bring any uneasiness from members of the legislature that we spoke to. And so that's the number that ended up being in the legislation that's been signed by Governor Brewer. It's 250 signatures in a council district system.
And in Phoenix, it's 250 for council, and their council, they have eight districts. So there's about almost 200,000 per district.
That's correct.
And ours are, what, 78,000? And their mayor's is 1,250, I think?
73.
I'm not certain of that.
I remember, Linda, I think it was 1250 in Phoenix for a city of a 1.5 million, almost 1.6 million. So, okay. Vice Mayor?
Mayor, and just on one final note, if that's a direction that council wants to head, make sure that everybody's comfortable with the emergency clause. And I know that we don't use the emergency clause often, but given the short time frame between now and the fact that signatures have to be in before May 30th, the role of the mayor is essential in maintaining public safety and good order. And the mayor specifically has a role.
I was going to say? Because that's a pretty high bar.
Well, no. You are the one that declares an emergency. You are the one that brings specific assets into the city if something were to happen in this community. And having a mayor is essential to running good governments. Even you. So I'm sorry, I had to dig. I tried not to.
I always
got to
have a butt in there, don't you?
I got to have a butt. So having candidates, good candidates to run is crucial for that. And so I think if we were going to use that clause, that this would certainly fit that, in my opinion.
Councilman Richards?
And the difference between these two situations is that the mayor's signature threshold is existing law passed last year, and the council member change happened this year and doesn't go into effect. So the mayoral law, state law, is already in effect.
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, Councilman Fender?
You know, one thing, we're 2 weeks, roughly a little over 2 weeks into the period of time when someone can announce for mayor and then gather signatures. I think there's still plenty of time left, so it doesn't disadvantage anybody. Probably is an advantage to anybody that's out there that might want to take on our good mayor. So Leaves plenty.
Is that an advertisement?
No, no.
Is that a plea?
No, I just don't want people to think that we were gaming a system or trying to make it to an advantage.
Yeah, I should be arguing here about
right.
keeping the status
the
quo.
Right. And so I think that's a very fair use. It leaves plenty of time for folks to be able to, if they wanted to go for mayor, have a reduced rate of signatures and still have plenty of time to run. So I don't see a problem with it initially. So,
how do you feel about that?
I have no feelings one way or another at this time. I'm numb. okay, so I guess what I'm hearing is to move forward with two ordinances, mm-hmm. as discussed. Both on Monday.
Introduction for the council districts and
emergency
for
clause
adoption
on the,
with the emergency clause for the office of the mayor.
The mayor.
Correct.
Okay, is that
yep.
that okay? All right.
If we could have a 10-minute break.
Before we vote?
No, like right now.
Okay. Well, I think that's the direction we have. And all right, I will give you not a 10-minute break, but a 7-minute break. And we'll start, whether you're here or not, at 20 till.
Perfect.
Okay? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So.
I just wanted to say I'm the only one back at my seat at 7:40, which was the mayor's rules.
Thank you. Next item on our agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss provide direction on form-based code. Mr. Wesley.
It's over to Jeff and the consultant. So.
You're turning over to what? The gentleman?
Yeah.
To Jeff. Mr. McVeigh.
Thank you, Mayor, Council. I'm actually very happy to be here to share with you the results of over 2 years of work on the form-based code. With me today is Dan Parolik of Opticos Design, a nationally recognized form-based coding firm. We know you still have a big agenda, so Dan's going to make just a short presentation, and I'm going to hand the floor over to him.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Council. We've been working on this code for just a little over 2 years, but I'm still amazed to be reminded, even after the couple of years of coming back and forth a couple of times to Mesa, the amazing potential that your downtown has, especially in light of the light rail about to be extended into it. And so I'm thrilled to be here sort of near the end of this process, getting close to sort of adoption, to just walk you through quickly where the code is at and some few of the framework items within the code. I'm going to go through about a 10-minute presentation that was intended to be about 25, which I gave last night. So feel free to ask questions as I go through this very quickly. The first thing, I often talk about form-based coding as a paradigm shift from a planning and zoning standpoint. But as I thought about preparing for this presentation to you all today, I realized that it's also a paradigm shift in terms of decision making, and that as you all move forward with the form-based code, you can really utilize this as a tool to establish this new brand for your downtown and use it as a tool to help protect that new brand and image for your downtown. So I'm really excited to think about that and really using it as a tool to really capture the transformative potential that the light rail has as it extends into your downtown. The first concept that I want to just quickly go through is that one of the overarching principles with the form-based code is reinforcing a hierarchy of walkable urban places. And I just wanted to quickly walk you through some of these, because I think all of these particular areas play an important role in defining the downtown, not just as an urban neighborhood, but also as a central commercial and entertainment destination as well. For each of these areas, we've obviously thought very closely about form, but we've also thought quite a bit about use as well in terms of supporting that form and making sure there's not conflicts. And as you'll see as I go quickly through these, there's really each one of these zones is thinking about a transition from the most intense along Main Street and transitioning into the least intense zones as you get into the bungalow neighborhoods, which is the first of the zones, which is a T3 neighborhood. And these areas apply primarily to existing historic districts and the single-family bungalow neighborhoods that exist in your downtown. Really, the primary objective is simply reinforcing and protecting the existing quality of walkable urban living that these places provide in close proximity to your main street. Then we jump to T4 neighborhood, sort of transitioning from those T3 neighborhoods, getting closer to Main Street. The point that I want to make with these is this particular zone is primarily about creating high quality, small footprint density, providing a really a good housing alternative for somebody who may want to move to your downtown, may not want to live in a single family home, and may also may not want to live in a larger condo like you might see a closer to Main Street. Then you have the T5 Main Street, and this is really a large portion of your Main Street area between Country Club and Pioneer Park gets this particular destination where it's secondary but very supportive of the Main Street activity that happens at the really the true center. Looking at, you know, multi-story uses, an active ground floor with, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 stories of residential or commercial uses above to get those rooftops, to get those businesses down on your Main Street to actually begin to create some vibrancy and to attract more people to your downtown. The T5 Main Street Flex, I wanted to make an important I thought it was important to talk a bit about the flex zones because the T5 Main Street Flex requires the same form as the Main Street zone, but the flex shows that there's actually a lot more flexibility in the types of uses that can happen in that particular zone. So you can see on this graphic that the areas just to the north and the south of Main Street going between Main Street and First Street and First Avenue, a large percentage of those areas are this T5 Main Street Flex. So it provides a really wide range of opportunities for different uses within a defined form for those particular areas as they transition from the Main Street commercial core into the neighborhoods to both the north and the south. This is just an image from a project in Austin that we've seen recently that actually we felt embodied this idea of the ground floor spaces being designed such that they could accommodate a live-work sort of living space, but they could also ultimately transition into a cafe, a restaurant, or any other type of commercial, retail, or supportive use on that ground floor at the point at which the market supports that type of use in those areas. So the last of the zones and the most intense from a form and sort of complexity of use is the T6 Main Street. And as you can see from the regulating plan, pretty small area within your downtown designated as the T6 Main Street, really primarily the area between Center and Centennial. This reinforces this particular area as the real heart and primary activity center within your downtown. Kind of this is the area where I would call it kind of prime real estate and where you actually want the most active of ground floor uses activating this particular block. As you can see, based on this photograph, this is where the buildings can get substantially taller in terms of the hierarchy of the form. We've actually thought quite a bit about use. I just wanted to show on the right-hand side a quick extract of the use tables to just simply show that we've considered not only the range of uses, but also the types of uses, as well as whether or not they might want to be allowed on the ground floor or above or behind the primary uses. A lot of thought went into the land use tables to support the right type of activity within the form-based area in your downtown. Just wanted to make a quick point that details really do matter. To get you to that vibrant Main Street that everybody really seems to be longing for, as well as the vibrant neighborhoods adjacent to your Main Street. Just wanted to simply mention that the good frontage in the T5 and T6 zones do a couple of different things. They invite pedestrians in, like a good shop like this one would do. It also spills activity out onto the sidewalk, whether it be a sort of a restaurant or a cafe that can sort of open up and engage the pedestrians passing by and invite people in. But use is also important in that conversation. And so this was actually a photo from a Pleasant Hill Transit Village that we've actually been administering their form-based code. And they actually, really well-designed project, placed some inactive uses in the heart of their Main Street area. And at the point at which when the retail consultant finally came in to program the space, they'd kind of put themselves into a bit of a corner in terms of trying to create a continuous active street front along their Main Street area. A quick test run through the code. It's just kind of, if you were a property owner, how would you actually use the code? I mean, I use the T4 neighborhood as an example, just picked one lot north of Main Street here on 2nd Street. The first point would be simply finding your property on the zoning map and determine the zone. Secondly, going to the building form standards for that particular zone. This is obviously the real meat of the regulations. A large percentage of the regulations occur within the building form standards. Setbacks or build to the heights, the appropriate and allowed uses reside within the building form standards. The second step is then selecting an allowed building type from the list of building types that are actually the multiple building types that are allowed within each zone. This particular instance, we're just assuming the property owner, for example, picked the courtyard building, which is one of the buildings that we're trying to encourage within the T4 neighborhood zone. Then the next step is selecting allowed frontage type. Once again, there's multiple frontages that are allowed within each zone. So simply picking those and supplementing the regulations and the building form standards with the frontage type standards. Just an example of a T4 neighborhood condition. The idea is that going from a vacant or underutilized lot like this to a high quality sort of urban living in a courtyard housing project. And so if you have a larger project, whether it be one of the special planning areas or even a gray field, maybe an old dead shopping mall that a property owner has decided to use the form-based code on, you have to take a couple of additional steps. You can pick from the thoroughfare standards that exist within the form-based code. We have pre-designed sort of off-the-shelf thoroughfare standards that have been approved by the city. Or you can pick from the kit of parts that are also pre-approved to put them together to create your own thoroughfare standards. So I just wanted to make the point simply that you now have the plan document. You have the presentations from the charrette, and I just want to encourage you to use those as a basis by which you make decisions in the future. And the other thing I want to encourage
I think that's important. What do you mean by do not compromise?
I think you have to make some tough decisions, and you have to. What we found is that in like Hercules, California, for example, that at some point a project is just not the right fit for your vision and for the form-based code. And so the ability to push back, and at some point if the developer or builder is not ready and willing to provide the right project, then at some point you have to have the ability to say no to a project.
Based on the long-term vision.
Based on the long-term vision. You don't want to compromise.
May not be a bad project.
Yes, you sort of need to look toward the long term and make sure you don't put roadblocks in place to achieve that long term vision. The last couple of points I wanted to make is to make sure that you set the bar high for quality.
Wait, go back to that.
Yes.
You have something I can barely read on that.
Yes. So
because you're an outsider, I'd like to get your impression on what that second thing is.
Yeah, so needing to get beyond Mesa being seen primarily as the least expensive place to live to a place that people make the decision as their first choice to come to live in the downtown. It's a great option. I've talked about in past presentations that not only do you have potential in your downtown that few other cities have based on the framework that's already in place, but in particular with the city-owned property and your large city-owned the special planning areas that we've designated within the visioning documents, that you have an opportunity to make a really big impact and to actually rebrand and recreate this new identity for downtown Mesa so that it is the place that businesses are choosing to make to place their corporate offices, where people who want to live close to transit choose to live in downtown. Because I guess my image from an outsider's point of view is that a lot of people see Mesa as, well, you know, we'll kind of go make a decision to move there because it's kind of the least expensive decision to make. But we want to sort of rebrand downtown and make it competitive with downtown Phoenix, make it competitive with downtown Tempe as a place that people choose to live and that businesses choose to locate their offices. So I think it's pretty easy to state that, you know, you don't want to be this in 15 or 20 years, a place with kind of ambiguous public spaces that aren't really effective or useful, and buildings that kind of feel out of date or really aren't sort of working toward a goal of creating a brand or a strong identity for a community. Just wanted to say a couple things. Getting to early quality results is very important. We've learned this with several projects that we've kind of been on the city side helping them administer, of just making sure you set the bar high early on. You may need to set some standards for the quality that's intended. Just wanted to simply make that point of needing to think both short and midterm about that. And lastly, just you'll likely need to push back a little bit on most projects. We found that it's really rare, even with the most well-intended projects, that they kind of hit the bullseye on the first or second try. So just the ability and interest of the city of making sure that you're getting a project that meets your long-term objectives is really important. I also wanted to just simply make a point to reinforce what I've presented to you in the past. We're just asking you the question is, do you want to take the step of actually defining a character or brand for downtown Mesa that differentiates it from other communities? And, you know, the extreme in doing this is a place like Santa Barbara that obviously chose a very specific direction for its character, which obviously was very good from an economic development standpoint over the long term. It's not necessarily saying you need to go to that extreme, but simply you could go through the process of defining a brand through, you know, a colors, materials, elements that might help it respond more specifically to your desert context in an architecture that relates to that. So it was just a question I wanted to throw out to you to all begin to think about in terms of, once again, how are you differentiating downtown Mesa from your competitors and giving it that long-term competitive advantage? Just in conclusion, so I just wanted to say that it's really exciting to see the form-based code so close to kind of the final steps here of going through the approval process. Really do feel that it can be an effective tool for you all to use to help establish this brand and this high-quality place and protect that in downtown Mesa, as well as just making sure you're capturing the full benefit and potential of the transit impact as it comes into your downtown. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? None? Okay. Thank you very much.
Mayor.
Appreciate it.
This is coming along.
Next here, presentation, discuss broad direction of the police department budget.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. I've been told to make this quick, so I'm going to go a lights and siren on this one. We're happy to present our proposed budget for 2012-2013. To my right is Pam Alexander from our fiscal department. First thing I want to do is talk about our first innovative program is the Offender Reintegration and Enforcement Program. As you know, annually, thousands of inmates are released from Department of Corrections, and there's a high percentage of those inmates that commit crimes in our communities. This program is based and designed to focus, excuse me, on those repeat offenders. What we plan to do, and what makes this program unique, it's a holistic approach towards working with the inmates coming out. We are going to work with social community-based services. We're going to work with their probation officers, their parole officers. We're going to give them a chance to succeed. But if not, we will take enforcement actions on those repeat offenders. And that's what makes this this program different. In order to accomplish this, our offender reintegration program, we have identified four positions currently being held by sworn positions. And we would like to reclassify those positions to civilian. By doing this, this would give us four additional sworn officers for the offender reintegration program. And it would also add stability in those areas where the civilian members can add stability and more efficiency in those areas. That's the financial manager position, the fusion center manager, our aviation manager, and our management assistant one in the chief's office. In addition, our department has requested five additional officers to complement those four that will be reintegrated back into operations, giving us a total of nine officers, sworn officers, for this particular innovative program. The second program I want to talk about is a seized vehicle project, pilot project that we're looking at doing. This would allow our department to expand our department vehicle resources, specifically in the undercover areas. What the project is intended to do is to use serviceable seized vehicles that we seize during our operations, and those non-serviceable, we would auction those and use those funds, put them back into RICO funds to supplement our undercover vehicles. Currently, we lease several of our undercover vehicles. What this is intended to do, if there is a vehicle that is serviceable, we would put that in place and not have to pay our monthly lease fee. If it wasn't, we would auction it and then put that fund to fund additional vehicles. And what we're hoping is if we get vehicles that are still under warranty or if we purchase additional warranty, that would help on our reduce our maintenance costs also. The next program is to support the city court in their proposal to add 70 additional e-citation units. This program has been in place for about 10 months and it's been very successful. We've had over 8,647 cites that have been written through e-citation, which are a little over 12,000 violations. This obviously reduces cost and time with the courts processing the tickets, our staff having to process tickets. It's all electronic. So this has been a very good innovative technological impact. Next, I wanted to cover some budget highlights. As you may be aware of, Maricopa County has increased their jail cost for this year by a little over 25% in their booking rate and almost 17% on their housing rates.
Chief, could you explain the difference? Because we have our own jail. Who do we book in our holding facility, and who do we take down and has to be booked at Maricopa County? Are all of them booked? Are they booked twice, or are they just booked once and then delivered for incarceration? How does that work?
The suspects are brought into our holding facility first to be processed, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. If it's a bookable offense on a misdemeanor, they go over to county and we'll book them into jail there. That's where we get charged.
On a misdemeanor? Charged.
Yes.
Okay.
That's where we get charged. We get charged on misdemeanors. Felonies also go to the county, and it's the responsibility of the county to cover those costs. But all bookable offenses, if it's a warrant, it has to be booked. If it's a domestic violence, they have to be booked. There's certain charges which regulates who is booked and who is not. If they're repeat offenders, we also do cite and releases, like for some DUIs where we'll give them a ticket and an order to.
And that would be processing just in our facility?
It'd be processing. They would.
So the only time that we get the booking charge is if it's a misdemeanor that has to be incarcerated. That then is taken to county and booked there, and we're charged that fee.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
The increase is estimated to have an impact on the city about $1 million for this year. These increases have been incorporated in the budget office forecast. The police department, our jail fees are not part of the police department budget. Those are budgeted through the budget office. The Maricopa County was audited this year by a consultant, and what was discovered was that the county was overcharging the municipalities for the last several years on jail cost. What that resulted in was a refund to the city of Mesa for about $1.4 million. What we're recommending is that we utilize that refund from the county to purchase 28 patrol vehicles. The item that was pulled from today's agenda is our recommendation is utilizing these funds here. in fiscal year 2011, we reduced our fleet by 80 CNG vehicles to cut cost. What we found over the last couple years is that we do a 2-to-1 ratio for two officers to one vehicle, plus an 18% overage for downed vehicles. In the summer, that increases with the heat. And we estimate there were about 28 patrol vehicles short with utilizing that ratio, and that's where we came up with that 28 vehicles. Currently, our department has three freezers. Recent legislation changes have mandated that police departments maintain biological evidence for, in cases of homicide and sexual assaults, up to 55 years. What that has done is it's put a demand on our need for freezer space for our biological evidence. We currently have four freezers, three which are operational. We are recommending that we
just really quick, is that just that law? I know it's, but it's timely. Is that standard operating for most states, or are we out of line? Are we way over the top? Do you know what that is for, like, evidence retention? Because 55 years sounds huge. It's a lifetime. So most states like that, or is this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, most states are, due to the advancement in DNA, that's why we're seeing those times increase. DNA evidence from 20 years ago to now, they're able to solve those crimes. So it's just the advancement of the technology. That's why they're maintaining that we hold that evidence longer.
So that is like a nationwide standard, 55 years.
I don't want to say that it's a standard. I would have to do that research, but I do know that many of the states are increasing that time due to the ability to solve a lot of
All
crimes
right.
throughout.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and these are not your Frigidaire freezers. These freezers cost $715,000. They're very specialized for...
Wait, did you shop Spencer's first?
Yeah.
Because you can get a really good deal down there, and it's a Mesa business.
Yeah, it would be a good business. We are recommending that we utilize asset forfeiture funds and a RICO fund to pay for one of the freezers for this coming year. Something I just wanted to highlight, something that's really out in the future expenditure, and I just wanted to make council aware of it and keep it in the forecast, is the upgrade of our CAD system. This is something that the fire and police department continue to evaluate. There are no plans as for this year to upgrade or a possible replacement of CAD, but we do realize that our CAD system is getting old, and that expenditure will be looming in the future. So I just wanted to make everyone aware of that. Just an update on capital improvement programs, an update on the Fiesta District Police Station that was approved back in 2008. Construction is planned to begin in July or August of this year with a completion date of August 2013, so that's some good news. As we discussed previously, we discussed our aviation long-term plan. In our capital improvement future program is the helicopter replacement program. As you know, we have a 1996 model with over 19,000 flight hours, so we're looking at potentially wanting to replace that. The holding facility remodel, it was built in 1974, and it's had some minor upgrades over the years, but it really is very inadequate for today's... We want to make some improvements to modernize it and make more efficiency for safety, reutilize the room that we have there. It just needs a lot of work. We're looking at recommending about $273,000 to upgrade our current holding facility. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with the private jail. This is just really our holding facility to process.
Well, the question I have, and this may be premature, if we went to a private jail type scenario, do you envision maybe including a holding facility or that function in that jail, since it's local, or are they so different in their functions that the answer would be no?
We would like to maintain the holding facility because that's where we do all our processing. We'll get our fingerprints, we get our any DNA buccal swabs. It allows us to process them there, identify them. Oftentimes a suspect won't have ID and we have to actually run their prints and hold them until we're able
to
identify.
So the function is very different.
Yeah. Well, and Chief, remind, this is also where the courts has a judge.
Absolutely.
And that's an important part of this upgrade, too, is that making that work also.
Adjoined for a holding facility, we have where they have they can hold arraignments where the judges will see them and actually release them there, so we don't have to take.
Well, you could. You could do that in a private facility. The question is, you'd have to. It sounds to me like you'd have to build almost an entirely separate facility within the facility because the function is very different there than it is in would be in the private jail.
Right.
Okay.
Also on the capital improvement program is the remodel for the second floor of the old city court police building. Our intent is to use that for a multi-purpose facility to house some of our police operations.
How many floors is that, including?
Well, you have the second, the first, and then you have a basement.
One basement, one floor below.
Correct.
Okay.
And so we'll be talking about the next presentation about the other two floors.
Okay. So there's three floors total.
There's three floors. The idea is the second floor would be continue to be made available for future for this project.
And that would allow us more space for operations. The next slide is the financial overview, and I'm going to turn it over to Pam for that one.
Hello, Mayor, Council. Attached is the financial overview we've prepared for today. The final column is the proposed fiscal year 2012-2013 budget. And we outlined all the areas that need to be covered for this year, for the following year, I apologize, and to see if you had any questions. Okay.
I guess I do. I apologize for having gone through this in detail. Your 11-12 budget is $142 million. Your 11-12 year in estimate is $132 million. I'm trying to look at this as I go through where the big.
Explain.
Yeah, explain that.
I think there's some grants that aren't. We anticipated at the beginning of the year that aren't quite going to be materialized, or at least we're not going to expend them out. Is that correct? Am I saying
correct.
That correct?
Mayor, Council, the difference you see there is about $9.5 million, and approximately $3.4 million of that is grant money that we budgeted that we couldn't spend until October, and we have until September 30th of 2012 to spend those funds. So we will be carrying over those funds till 12/13 to spend.
Okay.
And then the remaining dollars are just money that we have and some personal services savings, some other savings that we do not anticipate being able to spend by June 30th.
Oh, okay. So a lot of this is timing.
Yeah.
A lot of this is timing. So
yes.
You're basically carrying over budget items from this year to next year. So it's not a real difference. It's just a timing issue.
Yep. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Those carryover. You'll see a carryover amount at the end of the year that help move those over into the next year's budget.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next item is to hear a presentation on the Economic Development Department. Mr. Jabjeniak.
Good morning, Mayor. Morning, Council. I will also try to be brief here this morning.
Is it still morning?
According to the clock, yes, sir. To my right is Ms. Jay O'Donnell, the Economic Development Office. She will assist here as we go forward. So as I start into this presentation, the first slide, Jay, if you would go to that one for me, is the Economic Development Mission Statement. I'm not going to really focus here, but I think it's important that we do look at our industries of opportunity because I think that's the framework of this budget presentation this morning. So as we know, healthcare, education, aerospace, tourism, and technology. I do, before I want to get into the main focal point, innovations. We're always trying to be more effective and more efficient, and one of those ways is with the CRM software, customer relationship management software. And while we're now getting a larger number of leads, our challenge to ourselves is how do we convert more of those, and this is a piece of innovation that we're looking for to be a little more efficient. So I want to spend the rest of the morning really talking about the Economic Development Investment Fund. And this is really comes from a budget presentation that was, I think, 29th of March and focused on three strategic areas: innovations with impact, infrastructure improvement and development, and obviously economic investment fund. Ours is focused on our industries of opportunity, otherwise known as HEAT. So the first item is healthcare. And really, we're basing our healthcare recruitment strategy on some of the success of the education initiative. We have been, I think, very fortunate with education, and we want to translate that into healthcare. There are two phases to the healthcare approach. We are looking to, first of all, focus on existing assets in healthcare, specifically to start off the Banner Simulation Center. Is there an opportunity there for medical training and other growth opportunities there? And also Banner Gateway and MD Anderson and the potential for growth around there. So that's phase one of a strategy. The second piece is to take a deeper dive into research and development opportunities. So it's not so much on retail healthcare opportunities, it's more on the research and development. Is there an opportunity in Mesa for life sciences, for bio, for that type of research? We have put aside about $45,000 for that next piece of recruitment strategy, building on a previous study that we had completed. Moving on to education. And really, we have now three buildings that are will be involved with the education initiative. The big building at 225 East Main Street, which Benedictine will occupy, scheduled for the fall of 13. But they will also start at a suite at 51 East Main Street. And we're looking to renovate that and provide an opportunity to for them to get in, get started, get their staff on the ground, and start to recruit for that fall of 13 opening. In addition to that, we have put the old court building at 245 West 2nd Street on the table as well for other educational institutions. The court rooms and the labs certainly have an appeal to the educational community, and we're currently working with architects now to lay out what that may look like, finalize budgets. But overall, we have set aside $14 million for these three buildings to accomplish the education initiative.
And I'm assuming you've talked about the coordination with police use and education.
Right.
Are there separate entrances, or is that something you'd want to design in or not design?
We're working on all those issues with that second floor to keep them separate, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why we've got the architects over there to look at that. But we think there's a possibility to accommodate both, because really the second floor is really an office area. It's really built out for a lot of different offices. So it doesn't even really work really well for the higher education space.
Most of the courtrooms were on the first floor?
The first, and there's a bank of them on the in the basement.
Oh, okay. Never having appeared in one of those, I wouldn't know that kind of thing. Not in that building, I didn't. In the new building, I have twice, but not in that building. Councilman Richens?
Do any education facilities that might locate there need office space for professors?
Well, again, in addition to the, if you think about when you go into that first floor space, there are either eight courtrooms on that first floor, I believe, something like that, three or four, whatever. And then right in the middle, there was that whole concentration of cubicle space, and then behind there's a whole bank of offices that wrap around the back side of it.
Okay.
There's quite a bit. There's a lot of space.
Basement, first floor, second floor, third floor?
On the first floor, that's what I'm talking about.
Total space.
Do you guys have the final?
Approximately 50,000 plus or minus square feet in the entire building, in the entire, all three floors,
basement,
lower level.
And then two upper floors. Mm-hmm. Okay.
There you go. Okay, so moving on from education, we're going into aerospace. And we occasionally get requests for support of businesses on airport, not surrounding, but on airport. Able Engineering is an example of that, and others. We also get requests to look at passenger traffic and how that may, we continue to grow that at Gateway specifically. So funds have been included in this economic investment fund in the tune of $300,000 to be able to look at, what's the flexibility? Do we have, what's our next investment? Is it another Able Engineering? what's the opportunity there? So that's what the money's earmarked for in that one. Under tourism, tourism is really focused on our spring training facilities. It's the debt service for the spring training facilities is here, as well as the development opportunities, the site improvements for other commercial development around Riverview. So there are several components there, but it really is focused on how do we grow at the Riverview area and at Hohokam and pay that debt service and future development opportunity. About $4.5 million set aside in that. Over to technology, and this is the biggest piece of this is Arizona AZ Labs, Arizona Labs for Security and Defense Research. We have hired a lion for business attraction and business property management. We are also paying utilities at that site. So there's a $2.3 million that is in the budget for this year, will be in for next year, as well as right next to that site is on the ASU campus, we've identified a site for the business accelerator. And that's really in partnership with ASU, and we've put aside just $71,000 to get started. And that is really for tenant improvements and utilities and a little bit of furniture to really get that off the ground here this fall. And that's the biggest piece of, or that's all of the technology. And then I think we go right into financial review. And I know that's a little hard to see. The biggest thing I want to point to here is we have added substantial amounts to this year's budget. And things like Alliance contract for the current year is now in this budget. So what was originally budgeted, we added to. Also, we have the grants that have commenced. All the expenses are here and showing, as well as the grants have to be added as a revenue side of this financial review.
And Mayor and Council, I think we should make note of it in this part of the presentation. We are also will be proposing that the position that we previously had identified in economic development for the downtown, I'm not sure what we refer to it
downtown
as.
Downtown project manager.
Downtown project manager, thank you. We'll be proposing that that position will be now included in the general fund funding, taking it out of the CDBG funding. So that's one of those positions that we'll be recommending to be funded in the general fund. And that'll help. For a lot of reasons, it's been the way that CB requirements, you know, the types of projects, not just limited to downtown, but creating jobs that are related to a very specific income and demographic were also required. And, you know, and that's kind of not always the case in working downtown. It can be a mix of working and attracting jobs, both for low income as well as professional and higher income. So it probably fits better in the general fund now. So,
Councilman Higgins?
Does the DMA budget, is that still in here? Like, is that still a line item in your... Okay.
That is part of our general fund budget,
great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Councilman Regents?
Where are some of the tenant improvements and leases and that kind of stuff for any of our initiatives? Is that, you know, any expenditure that we might have to do to improve the old police building or 5155? Does that come in economic development?
No, so what we'll do is all those, because the ability to fund those projects is in the enterprise fund. Even though they're economic development related, they're contained in the enterprise fund because the savings that we were able to identify through the refinancing is there. So next Monday, and the Audit and Finance Committee has seen the schedule, but the full council will see that schedule that'll identify all the financing that Bill has talked about today. You'll actually see those lined out. You'll see the cost for the technology labs. And we've tried to break them up in the different initiatives between healthcare, education. So you'll see those numbers now embedded in the enterprise fund.
So we put them there because they're real estate related, not...
Well, we put them there because that's where the savings have been generated. And we pulled them out, though, so you could... identify that specific schedule.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
And just a real quick note, just go looking at the department any capital type projects would not be in Bill's department. So even though he's overseeing economic development projects, they'd be located actually in our CIP department.
Yeah, that's true too.
So you don't see those costs sitting in his department. What you see is the operating costs. His $2.3 million in here for AZ Labs and so forth is our operating cost, not the construction cost.
Right.
So any kind of construction cost with the court or any other development project will actually not physically be in his department, but he will oversee them.
So you'll see that schedule on Monday.
Okay. Okay, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, Transportation Department, Mr. Clevenger.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Dan Clevenger, Transportation Department Director. With me are my deputies, Alan Sanderson and Benny Hume. Like the others, I know you've been here a long time this morning. I appreciate you fitting us in. I'm going to go quickly. Please feel free to stop me. I'm just going to jump right in here.
Green lights all the way through.
All right. This slide just identifies 16 distinct work groups that we have in the department, kind of showing our diversity of activities. Like the others before me, we'll talk briefly about some of our innovations. You're familiar with at least one of these, I know. This first one is the My Mesa smartphone app. We've had a lot of interest in this. It's been very popular. Since August 2010, when we first started this program, we've issued 11,000 work requests. And in fiscal year 11-12, we expect to abate over 1 million square feet of graffiti from this. And I know some of the council members are using this app, and I know a lot of our residents are, and it's been great. We started with just graffiti, and it's expanded to cover things like signing issues, bus stop maintenance, sidewalks, other non-urgent street concerns. And then we also have a feature now on there that does more hazardous conditions that prompts a phone number, so you can just push the button and it calls directly to report immediately, so we can act a little more quickly on that. Associated with that is the app order. This is a web-based database, really, that we can go in and easily create reports. It's a searchable database, and we can navigate or sort by name, reporting party, activities, dates, etc. PD can also use this for their use in aiding in prosecution of taggers. This item is our pavement management system. We have a current system we use. It's called MicroPave, and this system is really important to us because our paved streets are our biggest physical asset. We have over 3,200 lane miles of streets in Mesa, and with MicroPave, and we've been using that since 1984, it's really more of a database. There's some limitations to it. We've done some updates and upgrades over the years, but what we really need is something that's a little more diagnostic and helps us prioritize our projects. This project will do, or this system will do, for $175,000. It's a one-time. That'll give us a software license and convert all our data we've been maintaining since 1984. We'll be able to analyze and establish our priorities. What happens today with our MicroPave system, we have our technicians out, and they are manually inspecting and essentially grading our streets. And so it is a little bit subjective. And then for $25,000 a year, if you see that photo of that van, it's something we would contract out, not purchase. They're quite expensive. And they would gather data on our arterial streets to video, actually. They're videotaping and collecting data for us.
There's some fun family night activity watching video of pavement.
And so that also that helps with our safety as well. We get our guys out of the arterial streets.
Yeah, the amphitheater. Some hot summer night will do.
It's good stuff. This next item is our lumen management streetlight monitoring system. This is proposed. We got to continue some research on this. This isn't something we're going to implement right away. Some other jurisdictions around the country are starting to experiment with this. And what this will do for us is instead of us going out and riding lights, as we call it, at night, paying someone to go drive around and look for lights out. If we could get this system in place, we'd have early detection of failures. It would let us know where our outages are, circuit problems, wire theft even. And when we route our folks the next day, if you will, or for that week, we can route more efficiently. We'll know where all the outages are, and so you won't just be responding to the ones that are reported or the ones maybe we staff members have seen. And it's scalable. We'd like to get started on this sometime in the future, and it works best with the LED lights. For one reason, they're dimmable. And so we talk about lumen management. That's just a fancy way of talking about dimming. So we can save a lot of energy when we dim those lights. And you'll recall we recently, with ERA funds, we've installed 2,510, I think, street lights.
Yes.
And we will be doing more. There'll be some in the Fiesta District. There'll be
LED?
Some. Pardon?
LED streetlights?
LED streetlights.
Yes. Okay, I was going to ask you where the LED program was. Is that from a single, is that a single type, a single vendor? Is that a multiple type, or is it, you know?
Mayor, there's many vendors out there now. When we first got into business, when I first started doing them, there was three vendors that met the qualifications, but every year there's more vendors and suppliers providing the products.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I didn't ask in a good way. The 2,500 is meant as a block study to see how those work out. We're not like having 300 of one type, 400 of another type, and those type of things.
The 2,500 we put up, 2,510 we put up, actually was one brand, but we are still testing in many locations. Every time we have a vendor notifies us that they have a light that meets our standards, we put it up and test it out there. We have a test area.
And how long have those 2,500 been up?
Over a year now. Over a year.
Initial reactions?
We've had actually great responses. And in fact, many, surprisingly, I thought we'd hear more responses from the neighborhood. But actually, we're hearing the positive sides are the light is a wider light. It's not so much brighter light, but it's a wider light where you can see colors and distinctions. But also what we're seeing is that the maintenance is way down on them. We're not having to go out there and change those lamps out very often. They're also programmable, where we can change the light. If we have some light getting in the backyards of residents, we can actually program those lights to move.
And we've gone through one summer with them?
Yes, that's right.
And the heat?
The drivers have been working fine. That was some of our initial, 3 years ago plus, was our initial concerns on some of the first batches we got.
Okay. Thank you.
I've asked Lenny to just briefly touch on some of the issues we're having with our asphalt mix designs.
Yeah, as you've experienced and recognized some of the projects we had, some of the ERA projects and even some of our CIP projects, we've experienced some unusual asphalt failures and things such as bleeding and premature failures that we're seeing out there. We've had the contractor and suppliers come back and replace some of that asphalt. What we're proposing here as part of our baseline in our budget is to increase our testing pre and post. What has happened over the years, the asphalt's quality of the asphalt binder, or the glue that holds the material together, has decreased. The good stuff that we used to use to keep, they used to hold the asphalt together, is now being used as fuel for cars and diesel. They've been able to extract out that good product we need in there. So we're increasing our testing and to find out what admixtures we can add to strengthen the asphalts out there, and also try to get a little bit more of the human factor out of it. You realize, I equate it to baking a cake behind a paving machine, because it's mixing a bunch of product together and trying to get the right application out in the field. So we're trying to work on some testing materials and some admixtures we can put in the product to strengthen it up and get the life out of it.
No, if there's no questions on that, I'll move on to our capital improvement program. Excluding rebudgeted dollars from this year, your draft CIP will show about $65 million in capital improvements. Let me start with the streets portion. These are non-RTP or regional transportation plan projects. You can see them there in the dollar amounts. I'm just going to highlight the very last one. Mark Hirschberg touched on this one. This is adjacent to one of the parks. It's a 9-acre site. And needs some street improvements right in that vicinity. So that's Hawes and Medina. But I'll skip over this unless there's questions on any one of those projects. Next item is just touching on our ITS, our Intelligent Transportation Systems. We have three projects identified and funded for this next year. Some is replacements, some is the second item is just another application of our real-time adaptive system that's been installed around Superstition Springs Mall already, and then a project, you might just touch briefly maybe on the incident detection project, that is.
Sure, Mayor and Council members, the incident detection project is a way to use some new technology using Bluetooth devices that will sense travel speeds along arterial streets and send us alerts when they drop below what's typical, which is usually caused by an incident, a crash, or some unusual condition, just to keep better track and let us respond better to changing traffic conditions.
On to the
fire department, go chase down slow traffic.
Or respond to the incident.
We hadn't thought about that.
In the regional transportation program, we've got four projects. I think you're familiar with all four of these. The last two were identified to move forward by council with bond savings from the 2008 bond election. Want to just pause here briefly for the I-MESA connection. In reviewing all of the submittals to I-MESA, you look at the transportation items. I counted up 29 transportation-related ideas, garnering a total of 710 votes. If you look at those and kind of categorize them, you'll see there's over half are in support of pedestrian and bicycle projects. So that's part of our connection with parks and what Mark had talked about. This is what the folks have told us to date that what they'd like to see out there. So you'll see these four projects that are identified already. These are funded projects. The first one is just the start of very small portion of the Fiesta District project. We have $1 million grant. We're going to start spending that money on design for Fiesta Paseo. Alan will touch just briefly on the other three. We just have some renderings for those projects.
One is the Porter Park pathway that basically follows a buried canal that's kind of barren right now, you might say. It starts at northeast corner of 8th Street and Mesa Drive and goes in a northeasterly direction up towards Horn and Brown, and I think Councilmember Richens has been quite involved in supporting us on that project. We appreciate.
And let me interrupt for a second because I failed to mention something really important. Our staff's done a wonderful job applying for and being successful in getting federal grants. Just in the last 3 years alone, we've gotten $6.5 million of federal funding for bike and ped projects. That's allowed us to build a consolidated canal, which we will touch on. As a matter of fact, I think it's on your council agenda for Monday, a contract for that, and that's $1.1 million project completely federally funded.
This is an improvement along Dobson Road between Broadway and Main. It started out as a concept to take a bike path across the railroad there where Longmore alignment is. We couldn't work that out because of the railroad crossing restrictions, so what we're doing is widening and doing providing room for a bike lane and doing some pedestrian improvements along Dobson Road in that area. And the consolidated canal, these are pictures from the second phase that was completed that took it out to Lindsay Road. The final phase, about ready to go out to award, as Dan mentioned, will complete it between Lindsay and Baseline, which will also connect with the canal that improvements Gilbert has made south of Baseline.
Between Lindsay and Baseline, you mean?
Mayor, it goes diagonally to the southeast.
Okay, so.
Along the consolidated canal, it takes a diagonal.
Well, I know it takes diagonal, but where does it cross at Lindsay? What's the other?
Oh, I'm sorry. East-west, it's at Pueblo between
Pueblo.
Southern
okay, thank
and
you. So that's about a mile and a half then. Or straight on a diagonal, maybe a little bit more.
Right,
than
that's about right.
A couple miles, okay.
Riverview, these are some of the planned ones. Riverview Rio Salado pathway will join up where Tempe has made improvements up to the border, more or less, at where 101 is. This would pick up and carry it from 101 at the Salt River, bring it into the Riverview Park area where we're planning a trailhead along with the Cubs facility, which would also gives access to all the pathways farther west through Tempe and even into Phoenix. Gateway is along 202 from South Power to Baseline in Southeast Mesa, and the West Mesa connector is making the final link If you follow that consolidated canal path along to the west, right now it ends at Country Club. And this will link it up between, go through the area there where the Mesa Country Club is and take it onto the, there's the map. Yeah. It's number three right here, and link it up with the Riverview.
The blue?
The blue is the existing consolidated canal, with which will be finished all the way to baseline. And so the two projects Alan referenced, labeled one and three here, are just the connection from near Hohokam going west. That will get you to Riverview. And then the number one project there goes from that point and connects to Tempe Town Lake. And the final project, the Gateway project, is shown. It's a 5.7-mile J shape down there. We have met with just a little resistance from our WCD on that one, as recent as yesterday. We're working with them on the feasibility of that one. We think it's a great project. We'll continue working with them. This just kind of shows a five-year look on our streets. I just wanted to highlight three of these, I think. The arterial road reconstruction, that's just continuing to address our streets that are beyond their useful life. We don't have operational dollars to address those, so that would have to come capital funding. The third item there, Mesa Drive and 10th Avenue, which is 10th Avenue to University. You're going to see two projects in here. They're really kind of one and the same. We have a funding source for Mesa Drive and Broadway intersection, which I'll talk about in a minute. But as we expand that one in the future after, I think everybody's been on Mesa Drive and seeing the construction there. This will be the next phase of that project moving to the north. And the last item, the Hawes and Williams Field, has also been called by some folks Gateway Boulevard. This is the roadway that would connect Hawes Road at Ray, looping over to Ellsworth, and that's near the east terminal. So that's we want to get this thing designed so we can be ready to go when we make that decision that it's time to move the terminal, and we've had so many emplanements that we wouldn't be holding anything up. Again, in the plan section, more ITS projects, and then we have two RTP projects, regional transportation plan from Prop 400, been identified. These have regional funding for a large portion, Mesa Drive and Broadway, that's the intersection I referenced, and then Stapleton University. Both of these have congestion and safety issues that we would be addressing. For future growth, there's a couple other street projects. The first two, the Warner and the Sossaman, are just really to provide access to some very developable land. We've already had some interest out there, but the city would work with them to build those streets to provide access for the development. We had two feasibility studies for Dobson and Main Street. Those are just to really look at the multimodal aspect, the transit, the bikes, the peds, vehicular or passenger vehicles, et cetera, and make sure everything's working as we expand our system. And that last item is just one more path. It's a 1.5-mile path that would connect into the gateway path that we referenced earlier. Operational budget real quick. We're looking at right now about $43.6 million. It's almost identical to what we expect to spend in this current fiscal year. We still do have some issues. I'm working with Candace. We have the mayor, you've talked about this before, the HERF impacts and what that's going to do to us, really. So that number may be revised downward as I work with Candace. So if you see a final number that's different than that, that's why, because we're taking that into account in our budget.
The idea there being that the HERF funds are being continued to be swept, kept by the state to fund DPS and other state expenditures, so that impacts that 43 could be anywhere to $2 million or so less
about
than what
million,
you're seeing there.
Potentially.
Which goes directly, those dollars go directly or come out of the street maintenance budget. That's where the adjustment is made.
Curious, on this course that we're heading with the amount of money that's being withdrawn for us to play for things like DPS, how much of DPS are we paying for?
Mr. Butler has that number, I think, don't you? Or some, you did it, I thought, at one point. Or do you have it? I heard someone quote the... The local contributions to DPS, are we at 50%? Do we own them yet?
I think by next year. Isn't by next year that was proposed that it's 100% funded with HERF?
Yeah.
Well, the next thing we're going to have to do is pay for their jailing costs.
Mayor and Council, I can get those exact numbers for you. I don't have them with me right now, but it's a sizable contribution both now to DPS and MVD on
As I recall, and it may be wrong, but in a previous presentation, we said we're moving from 50%, and either by next year or the year bond. It's anticipated in the long-term multi-year budget plans. It was presented that the that HERF would fund all of DPS. That's either next year or the year after that. I can't remember.
Yeah, I've heard that from someone.
Yes, Mayor, Council, you're right. I don't have the exact dollar figures, but it's definitely trending in that direction, and that's part of the concern. I think some of the frustration that you see in various groups that are out there talking about voter initiatives and other things that would try to restrict the legislature's ability to raid those funds, because it's just frustrating that I know over $1 billion has been diverted in the past decade from those funds, and that's...
Well, once again, HERF is our gas tax. HERF are what you pay when you fill up your car and what you pay when you register your car. And historically, those have primarily gone... to the state and local communities to fix roads, because cars tend to be the ones that use roads. I know that's a novel concept. The legislature decided with in a no tricks or gimmicks budget to take money that used to be used to fix potholes and use them to cover general fund, what was normally funded by the general fund in the state budget, and that was taking away from communities. And now there are other communities that are hurt a lot worse than we are. Especially some of the rural communities and smaller communities, their entire street department budget and what they had to fix their streets came out of the gas tax, which is what you would expect. You can't blame them for budgeting to the source of revenue. And that's one of the reasons why there's so many people that are upset at the overall state level, is because it's been a hit. For other communities who don't have a dedicated sales tax like we do, which has been our savior from the street side, they rely upon these much more than we do. So hopefully the legislature, I know there are some at the legislature to give them credit who are working to try and fix the situation, who share this thought that it's not right that all of those monies are diverted.
And Mayor, we will likely see portions of the budget next week, and so we'll have a better idea about the direction they're going for the coming fiscal.
But in the proposals that are out, there wasn't a whole lot of change, either the governor's or the preliminary budgets.
The only budget, Mayor, the only budget that we've seen publicly thus far has been the governor's budget, and you're correct, she recommended no changes to the current diversions. And what we've heard rumor, but at this point it's just rumor, that the legislature is looking at weaning off the MBD portion and keeping that flowing out to all the recipients of HERF. But it's just a rumor at this point until we actually see it on paper.
So. Okay.
So, Mayor, that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. I'm sure we all have some. We're just afraid to ask them. We're ready to go home. Okay. The next item is the acknowledged receipt of minutes on boards. I have a motion from the Vice Mayor, second from Councilmember Finter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Unless there's something somebody wants to talk about on meetings and conferences attended, Mr. Brady.
Yes, Mayor, just to remind the council, we have a pretty heavy study session for the 23rd. So we'll be beginning with a community facilities district board meeting, which the council could be composed of. So we'll start at 4:30. I also want to let the council know there is an announcement press conference. I believe this meeting is scheduled for 3:00 on Monday. Announcement of another higher education institution coming to Mesa. So we'll have that time at 3:00. So you'll prepare your schedules for that. And then just a reminder that there is a pancake breakfast this Saturday, April 28th, that Councilmember Kavanaugh, or not this Saturday, it'll be a week from Saturday, sorry, that Councilmember Kavanaugh is hosting at the Rhodes Pool. Thank you.
At the where?
Rhodes Pool.
Rhodes
Pool. Rider.
I bet you the Rose Bowl. I'm going.
Oh.
Whoa, okay. All right.
Nice, too. I'll go.
Okay. Ms. Crocker, any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
So moved.
I have a motion to adjourn from the Vice Mayor, 7 Councilmember Richens. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We are adjourned.